From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Bob Doty reporting. Hungary has declared a state of emergency in two southern counties as part of a crackdown on migrants trying to reach the European Union. Hungarian officials said Tuesday they also have closed two official border crossings because of what they said were inadequate controls on the Serbian side. Zoltán Kovács, a Hungarian government spokesman.
Due to the situation caused by mass migration, the Hungarian government declares a state of crisis, a crisis situation, which obviously enables police and other authorities on the ground for a special protocol. The duration is as long as it is necessary.
He said migrants who try to enter the country illegally will be automatically turned back.
In terms of the border zone, there's no change. It is about defending the border. The ability, the capabilities of police and the military has been reinforced.
The gap closed by Hungary in its border fence with Serbia has for weeks been used by migrants as a main unofficial entry point. North Korea on Tuesday said it has restarted normal operations at its main Yongbyon nuclear complex and warned it is ready to use nuclear weapons against the United States at any time. The comments published in the Korean Central News Agency come as Pyongyang also threatens to use banned ballistic missile technology to launch a weather satellite into orbit. The threats constitute a return to the belligerent rhetoric often employed by North Korea in an effort to obtain political concessions from South Korea and the United States, two of its main foes. Yongbyon is the center that produced the material used in North Korea's three nuclear tests. This is VOA News. Thai police have, for the first time, publicly linked last month's deadly bombing of a Bangkok shrine to China's Uyghur ethnic minority group. Investigators said Tuesday they believe the bombing was a revenge attack carried out by human traffickers. The cause was the human trafficking networks transferring Uyghurs from one country to another, said the national police chief. He went on to say Thai authorities destroyed or obstructed their human trafficking business. A month before the attack, Thailand forcibly deported to China more than 100 members of the Turkic-speaking Uyghur group, which complains of persecution by Beijing. Thai officials had for weeks hinted but refused to say definitively that mostly Muslim Uyghur group was linked to the August 17th bombing, which killed at least 20 people and injured dozens of others. Russian President Vladimir Putin defended his country's military support for Syria, saying Tuesday that Russia will continue to aid President Bashar al-Assad's forces in their fight against terrorist aggression. Speaking at a regional security conference in Tajikistan, Putin said Assad is open to working with the healthy opposition in Syria on a political solution to the conflict that has stretched on for 4.5 years, but that the focus must first be on terrorism. His comments come a day after the U.S. Defense Department confirmed reports that Russia appears to be setting up an airbase in Syria. Pentagon spokesman Captain Jeff Davis told reporters Monday that the movement of Russian personnel and equipment into an area near the coastal city of Latakia suggests the establishment of a forward operating base. Senior members of the Taliban have announced the resolution of a potential split within the group's leadership following Mullah Omar's death, with previously divided factions pledging their allegiance Tuesday to the group's new leader, Mullah Akhtar Mansour. Jared Blank, the U.S. government's special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, says he is absolutely hopeful that peace talks between the Taliban and the government in Kabul can resume soon. He told reporters that all the issues that came up during his talks in Pakistan will be on the agenda when Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif visits the White House next month to meet President Barack Obama. Two political novices, billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump and former neurosurgeon Ben Carson, topped the latest survey as the choice of U.S. Republicans for the party's 2016 presidential nomination. As the 16-candidate Republican field gets set for another round of debates Wednesday night, the CBS New York Times poll released Tuesday shows the flamboyant Trump with 27% support and a more reserved Carson trailing with 23%. The first voting in the long journey to picking presidential nominees in the U.S. is not scheduled until February 1st at caucuses in the rural state of Iowa. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The International Organization for Migration warns more migrants and refugees will die as a direct result of the European Union's inability to make a decision on how to tackle the crisis sweeping Europe.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from IOM headquarters in Geneva. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, Kenyan security forces launch an operation to oust al-Shabaab militants from the Kenya-Somalia border. The number of Mexican tourists who died in yesterday's military attack in Egypt's western desert has risen to 8. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from the DRC, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the International Organization for Migration warns more migrants and refugees will die as a direct result of the European Union's inability to make a decision on how to tackle the crisis sweeping Europe. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
September has been a deadly month for migrants. The International Organization for Migration reports the number of tragedies keep increasing. Just over the past few days, the IOM estimates 72 migrants have lost their lives trying to cross into the Greek islands from Turkey. And it says data received from the Turkish Coast Guard shows some 13 migrants already have died in Turkish waters through the beginning of September. IOM spokesman Leonard Doyle says this makes this month the deadliest on that stretch of the Mediterranean in 2 years, and that the situation will only worsen.
As the seasons turn and as the weather gets colder and as the dangers increase, we fear that the lack of decisions, that the indecisions in Europe will lead to more deaths in the Aegean.
European Council ministers meeting in Brussels Monday were unable to reach consensus on a proposal to relocate 120,000 people, most from Syria, in all member countries. Most of the migrants have been arriving in Greece and Italy, which are being overwhelmed by the numbers. Some countries, mainly in Central Europe, are unwilling to share the burden and offer asylum. The IOM set up a national toll-free 157 helpline in Turkey in 2005 to assist in the rescue of trafficking victims who are smuggled across the Mediterranean and Aegean seas in flimsy boats. Leonard Doyle says this hotline today acts as a lifeline for many. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says European ministers failed yesterday to take decisive action to end the refugee and migrant crisis in Europe. The agency says it welcomes the European Council of Ministers' adoption of an older plan to relocate 40,000 people. But the Council failed to reach consensus on the newer proposal to relocate 120,000 people. Babar Baluch is a spokesman for the UNHCR. He's currently in the Hungarian capital, Budapest. He's just returned from visiting a volatile border area. Hungary has strongly resisted allowing migrants and refugees into the country and has built a wall to keep them out. Baluch spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about his trip to the border and ongoing tensions over the crisis.
Yesterday, we were at the Hungary-Serbian border at this gap in the fence that Hungary has built at the train track where a lot of people were coming through. So yesterday afternoon, I was there with a lot of other humanitarians and journalists. Around 4 o'clock, that gap was closed. There were Hungarian policemen who came in a row and stopped people from entering. When I say people, a majority of them are Syrians, Afghans, and Iraqis fleeing war and conflict.
Now, Hungary has become one of the countries that has been standing very firm against the refugees and migrants coming in.
I think standing against a refugee population that is vulnerable, desperate, is not a correct thing to do. Refugees are fleeing war and persecution. We have been there talking to all these people, everyone has a story of loss to share. So for them, there was no other choice. They had to flee. So here they are knocking at the European borders, and Hungary is the first country. And we see this resistance in terms of allowing people in now that the fence is complete. But we want to see access for these desperate people. There's no other way out.
It must be frustrating for someone from the UNHCR to want to help the migrants and refugees, but they can't get into where you are. So what do you do?
I mean, we are present in other countries as well. We have been helping refugees all the way through. In Syria's neighborhood, where there are 4 million refugees, not everyone is packing up bags and coming to Europe. But European Union or European countries have obligation under the international law and also under the European laws. Seeking asylum or seeking refuge or international protection is not an offense. It's not a crime. So people who come asking for asylum, they should be allowed in.
Well, the European Council of Ministers met yesterday, and they formally adopted an earlier relocation proposal involving 40,000 people. They did not adopt the relocation proposal involving 120,000 people. What is the UNHCR's reaction to the ministers' meeting?
No, we are deeply disappointed. We have welcomed some of the gestures, some of the announcements, but we hope that 120,000 places that were put on table earlier and a final consensus could not be reached on this, countries were agreeing earlier, and now that has dropped down to 40,000. There's a lot of need for these people because these places need to be there to help countries like Greece, Italy, and Hungary. And the need is there because so many people are on the move. And we wanted that these relocation places would be accompanied by large-scale emergency reception, assistance, registration efforts in the countries more impacted by arrivals, like Hungary, where we are right now. But we are also welcoming some of the points that they have adopted. We hope the European Union will move onwards in terms of trying to find ways to help this desperate population. Because when we look at global displacement numbers and so many wars are displacing so many people, everyone needs to step forward and help them.
If you're disappointed with the allocation figures, what did you find positive by the ministers' meeting?
There was some positive development in here, some conclusion which said that there will be support for Greece in reception and asylum processes, which we welcomed it. And also the European countries will help Western Balkan countries to implement their own obligation in terms of protection for these people. But also one positive announcement was increase of support by the European Union and its member states to UNHCR respond in terms of needs for refugees in countries neighboring Syria. But also what we want is Europe's political will in terms of trying to help resolve the situation where Syria is today. If we focus our efforts on ending the wars, there won't be any more refugees.
Bab Arbaluc is a spokesman for the UNHCR. He's currently in the Hungarian capital, Budapest. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. In related news, Hungary has declared a state of emergency in two counties. Police have also closed 2 of 6 border crossings. They've also arrested 16 migrants who broke a new law by attempting to crawl under a barbed wire fence at Serbia's border. There are reports that the Hungarian army is assisting local police in crowd control. However, the nation's parliament is not expected to vote on troop deployment to its borders until next week. Most of an estimated 200,000 migrants entering Hungary have walked across the Serbian border en route to Germany and other EU counties. Hungary is among several EU countries that have rejected calls from Germany and the EU's Executive Commission to adopt mandatory quotas of refugees. Germany's interior minister today says he supports a movement among EU members to block structural funds to member states such as Hungary that refuse to share the burden of accommodating migrants. migrants. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, expects at least 850,000 migrants and refugees to head to the continent this year. Also, at the request of the UN Refugee Agency, Egyptian billionaire Naguib Sawaris has offered to buy an island in the Mediterranean to host migrants. The Egyptian businessman owns the mobile telephone network Orascom that operates in many Middle Eastern and African countries. Well, Kenyan security forces have launched an operation to oust al-Shabaab militants from the Boni Forest along the Kenya-Somalia border. Officials say the group has established camps in the forest to attack targets in Kenya. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan officials say some 300 al-Shabaab fighters are hiding in the Boni Forest. The government blames those fighters for deadly attacks in parts of coastal and northeastern Kenya. The operation is Kenya's third major offensive against al-Shabaab. In October 2011, Kenyan forces launched an operation to secure its borders after months of cross-border incursions from the Islamist militants. In 2012, Kenyan troops retook the Somali port city of Kismayu from al-Shabaab. Kenya's Interior Cabinet Secretary Joseph Olwenkeisery was present for the start of the current offensive Saturday. He said, "I've been sent by the President to launch this operation to make sure that there is peace and security in Boni Forest." A week earlier, the government ordered those living in the forest to vacate the area. According to Kenyan media, so far, 3,000 people have followed the order. But this man said residents feel abandoned. The government told us to leave the forest and we were not told where to go. Now we have left and we don't know where we are going. The government has assured the residents they will get the assistance they need. Security analyst Andrew Franklin says a tough battle awaits Kenyan forces since the forest covers more than 100 square kilometers.
The operation, even if it were properly resourced, which it is not, would be very difficult. The fact is that the Boni Forest is rather large. It also straddles the border with Somalia, which indicates that either we're going to coordinate operations with Somali National Army troops who are very thin on the ground, or we're just going to cross the border at will.
Kenya has faced increased terror attacks since its ramped up operations against al-Shabaab, most notably the assault on Westgate Mall in 2013 and Garissa University College in April of this year. According to government figures, more than 400 people have been killed overall. Homeland Security expert Richard Tuta says al-Shabaab is finding it easier to operate in Kenya than in Somalia.
On the Somali side, the KDF has managed to put al-Shabaab on the run. But now when you come to Homeland Security in Kenya itself, is that al-Shabaab have managed to be on the move. In Somalia, they are on the run. But in Kenya, they are on the move because of the conducive environment.
The operation to clear Boni Forest is expected to end in 3 months' time. But security experts say it will take longer. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Coming up on 19 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A new report scheduled for release next week in New York by the International Food Policy Research Institute, IFPRI, reveals that malnutrition exists in every country on the planet. It finds that malnutrition takes many forms, from extreme deprivation to obesity. IFPRI says the timing of the report is important, as UN members will be convening to adopt the Sustainable Development Goals. IFPRI calls on leaders to keep nutrition at the forefront of their global policies in order to end malnutrition. Lawrence Haddad is lead author of the study and a senior research fellow at IFPRI. He explains why malnutrition continues to plague the entire world.
It's in every country because adult forms are being addressed, sometimes not terribly successfully, but sometimes in some countries very successfully. New forms are emerging. So it's a multi-headed beast, if you like. We look at malnutrition in all its forms. So for some people, it's kids who are too short for their age. For some people, it's kids who are too thin. It could be women that are anemic. It could be overweight and obese individuals, and it could be individuals with diabetes and high blood pressure. So it has multiple faces, and just as one version is beaten down, another version pops up. It's also difficult to deal with unless the government is really committed, because it has so many causes. It's not just about food. It's not just about health. It's not just about water. It's not just about food systems. It's about all of those things. So countries that are really determined to do something about it, like Brazil and Ghana and Kenya and Ethiopia and Bangladesh and even India now, we are seeing really good progress. But it won't just go away with economic growth.
Malnutrition, it does affect the economic growth of a country on an overall basis. And in what ways does it affect countries?
Well, it's a massive drain on economic growth. The report has estimates that its countries lose 10, 11, 12% of their gross national product every year because of current levels of malnutrition. And it also affects families. You know, kids that were stunted and malnourished at three compared to their counterparts who are not malnourished at three, as adults, they're 30% more likely to be living in poverty. And that's because their brains don't develop that well. They don't learn as much in school. They're not as productive in the labor market. They don't earn as much income and as higher wages, and they eventually end up in poverty. So the costs are very high, but the really good thing is that the investments in doing something about it, in scaling up nutrition interventions, the returns you get are 16 to 1. So for every dollar, every peso, every rupee you spend, you get 16 back. When you convert that to a rate of return over a long period, that's a rate of return of 10%. I mean, that outperforms the U.S. stock market. It's massive.
Another factor affecting malnutrition or trying to end malnutrition that you all point out in your study is climate change. In what way does climate change affect the fight against malnutrition?
Climate is both a threat and an opportunity for nutrition. It's a threat because climate is going to change the way seasons work. There's going to be a lot of uncertainty about that. And we know that nutrition status is already very vulnerable to seasons. Here we cite a study that shows kids in India, their nutrition status depends on the month in which they are born. And that controls for a whole range of things like education and income and where they live. So the month in which they're born really affects their nutrition. Now, climate change is going to make that go haywire. So nutrition people really need to understand how to make their nutrition interventions climate-proof. But on the other hand, we know that dietary choices really affect carbon greenhouse gas emissions. So studies that have been done that we cite in the report show that certain types of diets have a lower emission footprint. There might be a space, a policy space, where there are good things for nutrition, but also good things for climate.
What types of diets have the less carbon emissions?
Well, generally, diets that have moderate amounts of red meat consumption is the big emitter because of the land use and because of the methane emissions from the animal. So it has a much heavier emissions footprint, if you like, than many other types of foods. But also foods that are highly processed and highly packaged, they also have a big emissions footprint. The meat story is very complicated, though, because you can't have a headline that says meat is bad, because for some countries and some populations, they need to eat more meat, because kids that are malnourished don't get enough vitamins and minerals from their staple diets of maize or rice or whatever it is. They need fish, they need some meat, they need these micronutrients.
UN member states will be convening later this month on sustainable development goals. So how important is it for them to make sure that they keep nutrition at the forefront of their policies?
It's really disappointing that nutrition is not more prominently featuring in the sustainable development goals. It's listed in one of the 17 goals, food and nutrition security, so that's good. But when you go below the headline, and you look at the targets, there are 169 targets. Nutrition is only mentioned in one of those targets. And when you look at the action target, it's not mentioned in any of those. And obesity is not mentioned once in any of the SDG documents. It's really a big missed opportunity. So in the report, we say nutrition champions everywhere need to fight harder, not for the goals and the targets, because I think that's all set now, but for the indicators. The indicators have not yet been finalized. They'll be finalized, I think, by the end of 2015. So there's still time to push and lobby for more nutrition indicators. Things like exclusive breastfeeding, thinness of kids, anemia in women, diet diversity in women. Those indicators need to be in there, and they're not at the moment.
That was Lawrence Haddad, Senior Research Fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute. He spoke with me from London. Well, the number of Mexican tourists who died in yesterday's military attack in Egypt's western desert has risen to 8. Egyptian forces mistakenly fired on 4 all-terrain vehicles parked at an oasis for lunch on Monday. Egyptian military sources say the troops were trailing terrorists who reportedly beheaded a resident of a nearby village when they encountered the safari convoy. Survivors and eyewitnesses say the military assault included a helicopter bombing attack. A total of 12 tourists, 4 of them Egyptians, died in what on the convoy. 10 others were injured. Mexican officials have condemned the attack and demanded an investigation. Egyptian authorities who apologized for the incident have not yet disclosed details. Tour company officials dispute government claims that the safari had not requested permission to travel in a restricted area. Well, authorities in Sierra Leone have demolished a wide section of the capital, leaving many homeless. The government says it had been warning the residents for years about the plan and that people were there illegally. But human rights groups are concerned. They say it's leaving the most vulnerable at much greater risk in the midst of an Ebola crisis. Nina DeVries has more from Freetown.
Juliana Sese is among the thousands affected by the demolitions. She's 23 years old and an Ebola survivor. She was living in an area known as Tambakula Village, a population of about 500 people. It was a fisherman's wharf with shops that some people like Sese also used as homes. The entire area was demolished several weeks ago, and now she's staying with a friend and sleeping in a room with 3 other adults, 2 toddlers and 2 babies. This is not how she pictured her life after recovering from the deadly disease that's killed more than 11,000 people across West Africa.
I'm feeling scared. As for the demolished place, I just said to myself, I just feel like killing myself because I don't know, I don't have where to start.
Sese says no one has offered her any help or compensation for the destruction of her home. She worries how she'll get by. Aside from several communities destroyed, an entire side of the main beach road in Freetown was also brought to the ground where restaurants and bars once stood. The government says it needed to clean up the area and make it more appealing to tourists. Deputy government spokesperson Ajibu Jallo says this has been the plan for years.
The last 3 years. There have been a series of meetings where they've told the chiefs, they've told the local chiefs around there that these people don't belong here.
Rights groups have raised concern about how the government is handling the situation. Solomon Sogbandi is the director for Amnesty International in Sierra Leone. He says the government has good intentions, but...
Why not look at an alternative sort of housing for these people? Relocate them somewhere, you know, because the fact of the matter, if you just evict them forcefully, it has a lot of other... human rights implications.
And health implications. Sogbandi says it's still rainy season and this can make people more prone to diseases like malaria if they don't have proper shelter. Jallo says some people were offered land elsewhere a couple of years ago. He says some residents did go, but then just kept coming back. But former residents say they have not been offered any help. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On Straight Talk Africa, Shaka Sali goes one-on-one with Uganda's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Sam Kutesa. The outgoing President of the United Nations General Assembly, the 69th session ends Tuesday. Mr. Kutesa will be with us live next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa.
When news is happening...
VOA Africa is there.
Mohammed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The International Organization for Migration warns more migrants and refugees will die as a direct result of the EU's inability to make a decision on how to tackle the crisis. Kenyan security forces launch an operation to oust al-Shabaab militants from the Kenya-Somalia border. And the number of Mexican tourists who died in yesterday's military attack in Egypt's western desert has risen to 8. Coming up, we'll have music from the DRC. And in our feature segment, the United Nations Environmental Program tackles outdoor air pollution. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand a Zimbabwean swimming star tops your sports report today.
Kim, Zimbabwe's Kirsty Coventry once again lived up to her Golden Girl nickname during the All-Africa Games swimming competition in Congo, Brazzaville. The two-time Olympic champion won 3 gold medals, as well as a bronze in Brazzaville. Since first diving in the pool in Algiers in 2007, Kirsty has posted a spectacular All-Africa Games record, a total of 22 medals won, including 14 gold. Coventry will celebrate her 32nd birthday on Wednesday. During a brief stop here in Washington, Kirsty talked with reporter Blessing Zulu about her performance in Brazzaville.
It's been an honor to represent Zimbabwe at the All Africa Games, and I was just very thankful that I was able to go there and do as well as I did.
Tell us, how do you prepare for such events?
We had prepared a month ago for the World Championships, and I had found some good times. So I knew coming into this that I'd be a little bit weaker because it's a little bit harder to stay so focused strength-wise for 3 weeks later, but we just did a good job of training and getting back into the pool as soon as we could. And, I think I was also just really excited. This is my last All Africa game, so it gave me the opportunity to not leave any energy outside of the pool. Everything was put into that every race.
So you cannot be convinced to try and go?
I don't think so. I think, I've said all along that Rio Olympics will be my last big international competition. And it was very sad. It did take me a little bit by surprise how emotional I got saying goodbye to the team. Being on the podium for the last time in Africa, it's always been such a big part of my career.
Let's turn to Rio 2016 at the 2004 Summer Olympics in Athens, Greece. You won 3 Olympic medals. And in 2008 at the Summer Olympic Games in Beijing, you won 4 medals. Are we going to see another repeat this time in Rio?
That's always the goal. The goal is to always, try to get onto the podium. Unfortunately, in London 2012, I dislocated my knee 4 months before and then got pneumonia 2 months before. I still managed to come sixth, but it was just short of my goal. So I felt that I wanted to give it one more chance. It is going to be challenging. There are a lot of very good swimmers swimming at the moment, especially in my event. So I'm looking forward to the challenge in the year ahead.
You have also been working with schools in Zimbabwe to promote swimming. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so I've set up a Kirsty Coventry Academy, and right now we're working with a school, Mother's Pack, and we've coached some teachers to become swimming coaches, and there's about 450 children going through the program, which we're very excited about.
Are we likely to see another Kirsty very soon?
I hope so. You know, there are a lot of young swimmers coming up. You know, the talent is there, and now we just need the support and the funding to make sure that we continue to support our athletes.
Lastly, I know you insist that you don't only represent Zimbabwe, but Africa. What is your message to your fans?
Just thank you so much. You know, I've really been so lucky to have so many amazing fans, not just in Africa, but around the world, and Zimbabweans that are everywhere. You know, through sport, I've managed to keep us all linked together. And I think that's something that's really amazing that sport does. And just, you know, thank you so much for your support over the years.
That's Zimbabwean swimming star Kirsty Coventry, who will celebrate her 32nd birthday on Wednesday. Kirsty won 4 medals, 3 of them gold, at the All-Africa Games in Congo, Brazzaville. And she was talking with reporter Blessing Zulu during a brief stop here in Washington. In All-Africa Games volleyball, Algeria won the gold medal in the men's tournament, beating host Congo Brazzaville in 3 sets in the final. The final score, 25-20, 25-22, and 27-25. The Congolese can leave the court with their heads held high in winning the silver medal. It's their best showing in men's volleyball at either the continental or international levels. Meanwhile, in a hard-fought third-place match, Egypt beat Rwanda 3-2 to win the bronze medal. The final score, 25-27, 26-24, 24-26, 25-17, and 15-13. In All-Africa Games women's volleyball, Kenya beat Cameroon 3-1 to win the gold medal. The final score, 15-25, 25-14, 25-15, and 25-19. Egypt again won the bronze medal, beating Seychelles 3-0 in the third-place match. The final score for our VOA volleyball fans, 25-17, 25-6, and 25-15. Meanwhile, in All-Africa Games athletics, Nigeria won the gold and the silver in the men's triple jump, as we hear now from the VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Defending champion Tosin Oke and Olumide Olamigoke clinched a 1-2 Nigerian triumph in men's triple jump, as Tunisia's Balti Sringe and Dora Mafudi secured a 1-2 Tunisian victory in women's pole vault on Wednesday. Republic of Congo's Frank Elembe Waka set a men's shot put championship record of 20.25 meters as Burkina Faso's Kimalu Letitia Bambara improved women's championship hammer throw record to 66.91 meters. On the track, Ivory Coast's Marie-José Talou won women's 100 meters in a championship record of 11.02 seconds as Ben Youssef Meite triumphed in men's 100 meters in an Ivory Coast record of 10.04 seconds. South African Antonio Alcana won men's 110-meter hurdles in a lifetime best of 13.32 seconds. Ethiopians Tsebelu Zewude and Mekonnen Gebremedin clinched gold medals in men's 10,000 meters and 1,500 meters respectively as Guliame Thierry of Mauritius won the decathlon. In women's events, Lisa Labishi of Seychelles triumphed in high jump as South African Caster Semenya won the 800 meters. They're playing basketball. We love that basketball. Still in Brazzaville, in women's basketball, Nigeria overwhelmed Republic of Congo 102-23. Gabon outwitted Algeria 69-57. Senegal beat Ivory Coast 69-55. And Mali outplayed Cameroon 65-54. In the men's game, Angola beat Republic of Congo 81-64 as Egypt dismissed Gabon 60-34. In women's handball, Ivory Coast outplayed the Democratic Republic of Congo 29-23. Senegal and Cameroon drew 19-all. Angola dismissed Nigeria 36-34. 7-25, and Republic of Congo outwitted Burkina Faso 39-18.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOANews.com.
And when you visit VOANews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. Also, follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is at @VOASunnySports. One of my latest tweets came from none other than Hall of Fame basketball center Bill Walton, who won two national titles in college at the University of California at Los Angeles, better known as UCLA, and two more pro titles in the NBA in 1977 with the Portland Trail Blazers and in 1986 with the Boston Celtics. Walton's pro career was cut short by a series of injuries. At various times, he broke his nose, foot, wrist, and leg. Anyways, the gist of Walton's tweet dealt with injuries, specifically foot injuries. Big Bill says he definitely agrees that there shouldn't be any timetables on returning to action when it comes to broken feet, that it puts too much pressure on the athlete to return too soon. Meanwhile, if you check out my Facebook page, you'll see a nice photo of the three All-Africa Games medal winners in the women's pole vault. Gold medalist Serene Balti from Tunisia, silver medalist Dora Mafoudi, also from Tunisia, and bronze medalist Sinali Ouattara from Ivory Coast. More All-Africa Games results. Senegal defeated host Congo Brazzaville Tuesday 3-1 to advance to Friday's gold medal match in the men's football tournament. Ibrahima Keita had two goals for Senegal, while Che Jeng scored the other. Merville and Duckett had Congo's goal. Senegal will play the winner of Tuesday's second semifinal between Nigeria and Burkina Faso. Meanwhile, in the All-Africa Games women's football tournament, Ghana beat Ivory Coast Tuesday 1-0 to advance to Friday's gold medal match. Samira Suleiman scored for the Ghanaian girls in the 15th minute in Brazzaville. Ghana will play the winner of Tuesday's second semifinal between Nigeria and Cameroon. Nigeria features the leading scorer in the women's tournament, Desire Oparanozie, who has 5 goals so far. Once again, if you're just tuning in now to the Voice of America, Senegal beat host Congo Brazzaville Tuesday 3-1 to advance to the gold medal match in All-Africa Games men's football, and Ghana defeated Ivory Coast 1-0. To go through to the gold medal match in All-Africa Games women's football. All-Africa Games excitement! Yes, I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
All right. Wow, Sonny, thanks for that excitement. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the United Nations Environmental Program tackling outdoor air pollution. And next, the first comprehensive national curriculum for primary and secondary education in South Sudan. But first, some music. Here is DRC's Fali Ipupa with Ndoki.
Franchement, hotel nangana numero moko na ebite soki na bengi na zwa ka chinois moko soki na lobi allo bonjour azongi c'est la kanga allo hi ha ntoko solo nini motema pasie moto dala kyo benga papa lelo papa pomwani akomi tala tonton oyo moto dala kyo benga mama lelo mama pomwani akomi vraiment tala petit oyo mama mama président big master
Fali Pupa with Ndoki.
Well, outdoor air pollution kills 3.7 million people per year around the world. The World Health Organization says the problem is knowing where it comes from. The United Nations Environmental Program is launching a low-cost tool to help officials keep watch over the air in their cities. VOA's Steve Barragona has more from Nairobi, Kenya.
Tabitha Wangeshi suffers from asthma. But with the little money she makes selling charcoal, she can't always afford the medicine to treat it.
My chest is always blocked, like my ribs are dried up. From there, I start breathing heavily. I run out of oxygen, then I start breathing heavily.
Across town at Kenyatta National Hospital, Dr. Ndambuki Mboloi says there is one factor causing breathing problems all over Nairobi.
Air pollution is a big problem within the city.
The city's dirty vehicles and notorious traffic are the leading source of dangerous gases and particles in the air. Mbuloi says the toxic haze that shrouds Nairobi raises rates of asthma, heart disease, lung disease, and airway infections.
By judging with the number of patients that we see who present with the respiratory problems, it may be getting worse.
So all over the developing world, cities are growing fast, and with them, the traffic, and with the traffic, the pollution. And we know it's bad, but we don't know how bad it is because no one's been checking.
Experts say there is very little data on air pollution and its consequences in the cities of Africa or much of the developing world. But the UN Environment Program hopes to change that with this little box.
The technology that we are launching today is a way to measure that very accurately and very cheaply.
These little boxes measure all the major air pollutants for about 100 times less than the typical monitor. McLeod says cities can build an effective network of monitors at a price they can afford.
And they're able then to do the apportionment to find out the source of the pollution and then act on that.
So policies can target a city's biggest problems, whether it's burning trash or industrial pollution or emissions from dirty vehicles. And the world's rapidly growing cities can have the information they need to control pollution that each year kills millions and harms millions more. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Nairobi.
The South Sudan Ministry of Education has launched what is considered the first comprehensive national curriculum for primary and secondary education since the country became independent in 2011. Reporter Nabil Biagio has the story.
The ceremony was held in collaboration with the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, at the Juba Grand Hotel. South Sudan Vice President Wani Iga highlighted what he calls the national objectives behind the new curriculum.
It aims to produce, number one, proud citizens of South Sudan who understand their rich culture and heritage, actively participate in society, committed to unity, democracy, peace and reconciliation.
Iga says the curriculum is also designed to create critical thinkers.
Independent, lifelong learners who have mastered the key learning at schools and can learn independently with others. Number three, create confident and productive individuals. Number four, develop citizens who are environmentally aware.
Iga and others are hailing this as the first comprehensive 100% South Sudanese curriculum. The one adopted after independence was a hodgepodge of textbooks and teachings that drew from Ugandan and Sudanese curriculums. Even today, some students still study from these materials. Minister of Education Dr. John Guy says even though the new curriculum, which has been in the making since 2013, is finally fully developed and approved, it is just the beginning of a long journey toward achieving top-notch education.
We need teachers to be trained to do this work. But teachers must be trained somewhere. We have 5 teachers training institutes where we are able to train as many teachers as possible. But we need 3 things. One, we need to recruit those teachers. Number 2, we need to make sure that there's a food in that place. And finally, we want to make sure that this curriculum is actually taught in that place.
Guy says the country needs more education funding. The ministry has been receiving funds from donors and partners such as the aid group DFID, UNICEF, and UNESCO. He says the government must contribute more money to publish textbooks that feature the new curriculum. And Guy says there is one more thing the curriculum needs.
We cannot do and implement this curriculum without effective curriculum development center. And we need to develop it by recruiting qualified subject specialists. If we don't do that, it will become difficult for us to implement this.
Other difficulties that lie ahead include the transition from Arabic to English as the language of instruction in schools. This process began shortly after South Sudan became an independent country in 2011, but has made little headway so far. Guy says in order to address this issue, the government of South Sudan will seek the support of education experts in neighboring English-speaking countries such as Uganda and Kenya. Some of these experts were at the ceremony yesterday. Jonathan Vietch is the UNICEF representative in South Sudan.
UNICEF was responsible with DFID and the Global Partnership for Education
for supporting the development of this, but it's not us who did it. You saw all the academics, all the leaders in education sitting in the room with us, crowded room, some old men now who've been working on this for many years, and some young ladies also.
VH says the next steps will be challenging, but they must be pursued in order to implement the new curriculum.
We've got a curriculum, but now we need to turn it into textbooks. We need to teach every teacher in the country, and we need to roll it out across the country. That's going to take some time. It's going to cost a lot of money. But you can see that there's political commitment from the government, and that's a wonderful thing.
South Sudan is estimated to have one of the highest illiteracy rates in the world. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Somalia, long torn by clan rivalries, stricken by drought and resulting famine, and attacks by a militant extremist group, has made many strides since completing its political transition in 2012. In a nation once synonymous with chaos, there are now signs of improved security and economic growth. Throughout the process, the United States has stood with the Somali people, providing security, governance, and humanitarian assistance to help strengthen democratic institutions and improve stability. Recognizing Somalia's progress, and as a sign of our nation's deepening relationship with it, the U.S. mission to Somalia began operations on September 8th. It is based within the United States Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya, and will be headed by a chargé d'affaires until President Obama appoints and the Senate confirms the next U.S. ambassador. It's a critical step towards normalizing the U.S.-Somalia bilateral relationship, since our recognition of the federal government of Somalia on January 13th, as announced by Secretary of State John Kerry on May 5th during his historic visit to Mogadishu. Since our embassy closed in 1991 amid the country's then-growing instability, the United States conducted diplomacy on Somalia affairs based out of Nairobi. Over the past 5 years, U.S. officials began to travel more frequently into Somalia to conduct official business. When security conditions permit, it is envisioned that an embassy will be reestablished in Mogadishu. While Somalia has come far in the last 2 years, many challenges and threats remain. The Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists Al-Shabaab have been weakened but not defeated. Government services are uneven, and tens of thousands of Somalis remain displaced from their homes by violence. To keep making progress, the pivotal test for Somalia will not be securing more aid from the United States and international partners, but for its leaders to put their loyalties and differences behind them and commit to working together for the common good.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat.
hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.